It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So how are you all feeling about the ongoing Lawfare auction and all of us becoming Q-level celebrities? Or I don't know what the right
level. I was already
right
a Q-level celebrity.
I guess you were. You're the original Q-level celebrity. But I mean, you got your own black hole of political doom post-it note going. What's that? Are you obsessively checking your worth on the marketplace?
No. Yes, listener, you can bid on the post-it note that I drew about the benefit to Trump politically from delaying his trial. I don't know why you would want to do that, but you can. I will say I thought seriously about going to art school at a certain point in my life. So this is like a vision into an alternative path that I chose not to take.
It is a handsomely drawn post-it note. I'll
Thank
give you,
you.
That.
Thank you. Molly Reynolds told me that the lines were very straight. So thank you to my high school art teacher.
It's a Quinta Jurassic original. I mean, it should be worth thousands. Alan, what are you going to contribute to the auction?
I already contributed. I signed the puzzle.
We need an Alan Rosenstein original. What's it going to be?
So the problem is that unlike Quinta, I have no visual talent whatsoever. I have no visual talent. My wife, we're musicians, both of us. We have no visual talent. And as our children
musical talent, so we're even.
Well, it's funny because as our children are getting older, like my kid is now three. And so you can sort of tell like what his predilections are. And it's very much into music. And for like all the arts and crafts stuff, somehow his stuff he brings back from daycare is like even browner and splotchier than all the other kids. So it's a music thing, I think, in our household. I could like, you know, I could do the thing where I could like sing a song for someone's voicemail. I'm not sure anyone's going to pay for that, but
that's a good idea. That's a good one. I think you should record a single. Maybe you can take, you know, do it like improv style, just take suggestions for a theme and then write a song on it and record it.
There was a New York Times article about a guy who made $200,000 last year by just putting songs on Spotify about like everything. Movies that he likes, and apparently he has a lot of songs about going to the bathroom for kids. And all his songs are like, you know, a minute and 30 seconds long or something like that. And he's an artist, I guess.
See, Alan?
So that could be you.
I missed my calling, clearly.
Do it for Lawfare.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security. I'm Alan Rosenstein and I'm here with one of my regular co-hosts, Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
Scott is still on his parental
dead.
Leave, but dead.
To us.
Just behind the... Scott is still dead behind the eyes on parental leave because I'm sure he's not sleeping. But we are lucky to have Natalie Norpit Orpit, Lawfare's executive editor here. Thanks for joining us, Natalie.
Thank you.
And we are very excited to talk through another busy week of national security news with you on what we are calling, in honor of the ongoing Lawfare auction, the Going Once, Going Twice edition. First topic today, a gag order prevents me from telling you what the segment is called. After former President Donald Trump attacked the daughter of Judge Juan Merchan, who was overseeing his New York hush money trial, Judge Merchan expanded the gag order he had previously imposed to prohibit Trump from attacking his family. This is only the latest in what has become a pattern of Trump testing gag orders in his many legal cases. Why have these orders become such an important part of the Trump cases, and how far should they reach? Topic 2. The global importance of the Middle East is that it keeps the Far East and the Near East from encroaching on one another. Do you guys know what
is
brilliant
that a
statesman?
To something? No. Who
yeah,
said that?
Yeah. That's one of Dan Quayle's best
Dan
things
Quayle.
He's ever
I was
said. That's
say it.
My favorite Dan Quayle-ism.
I assume he was
I love
not
it
joking.
So much. No, oh, no, of course not. That's what makes it amazing. But I love this so much. 30 years later, it's still true. Even by the standards of the last few months, it's been a particularly busy week in Israel. In just 48 hours, an Israeli strike in Syria killed high-level Iranian military officials. Another strike in Gaza mistakenly killed several aid workers in a World Central Kitchen convoy. And a controversy around conscripting ultra-Orthodox men into the IDF is threatening Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition. What comes next, and is the crisis in the Middle East entering an even more chaotic period? And topic three, disinformation peaking turducken. An amazing thread on X involving Alex Jones, Russian lies about the CIA sending Nazis to fight in Ukraine, and a Chinese MAGA disinformation campaign is just one preview of how messy the 2024 election season is going to be. Is this 2016 all over again? And what, if anything, can be done to safeguard the U.S. information space against foreign actors? For the first topic, I'm going to turn it over to me. So Judge Juan Merchan is overseeing the New York State case against Donald Trump. This is the case that's been brought by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg for business fraud stemming from hush money payments that Trump made to the porn star Stormy Daniels to cover up an affair that he allegedly had with her. Now, last week, Judge Merchan issued an order limiting Trump's ability to comment about the trial, noting that Trump had already made, quote, threatening, inflammatory, and denigrating comments about court officials, witnesses, and others in both this case and his many other cases. Judge Merchan prohibited Trump from talking about, among others, the family of counsel or court staff. But notably, the gag order did not cover Merchan himself or his family. And so, true to form, the very next day, Trump started posting on his platform Truth Social about Lauren Merchan, Judge Merchan's daughter, and who runs a Democratic-leaning political consulting firm. For example, Trump posted that Merchan's daughter is, quote, a rabid Trump hater who has admitted to having conversations with her father about me, and yet he gagged me. The DA then requested that Merchan, quote, clarify his order to hold that it covered attacks on Merchan's family, and on Monday, Merchan explicitly expanded his order to prohibit Trump from attacking his family, although Merchan himself remains fair game. Now, it's only been a few days since this updated order, and Trump is already testing it, having posted a clip of a Fox & Friends news broadcast in which the host criticized Merchan's expanded gag order and Lauren Merchan herself, calling her a, quote, activist who works for Kamala Harris. I want to start with Natalie. So before we get into this specific gag order, can we just step back for a second and just explain kind of what gag orders are and what their purpose is? Because obviously they're quite controversial. You're preventing someone who is on trial for their life or liberty from being able to speak.
Right. So gag orders are, as you say, actually relatively infrequently imposed because they do present a lot of difficulties. In the criminal context, right, you have a prosecutor and a defendant. The prosecutor has enormously more power and influence over the proceedings just by virtue of representing the state and having brought the indictment in the first place. We in this country give a lot of deference to the ability of defendants to robustly represent themselves. We also care very deeply about the First Amendment here, and a surprise to no one. There's sort of a disfavor of imposing restrictions on defendants for both of those reasons. Gag orders are traditionally applied where there is a specific reason to be concerned that a defendant's statements are going to have a negative impact on the integrity of the proceedings and, for one reason or another, compromise the ability of the court to ensure that the trial is fair. So one thing that I thought was interesting about this particular order is Judge Merchan actually sort of addresses this directly in a way that I think was sort of forward-leaning. He talked about how the traditional concern for gag orders is these First Amendment rights for the defendant and this power imbalance that I was just talking about. But he says, with respect to Trump in particular, that sort of David versus Goliath dynamic is actually somewhat reversed because Trump has this, he used the word singular power on countless others to affect people whenever he makes a statement. So the traditional power imbalance is not the same, which sort of changes the calculus for whether a gag order is warranted here, in addition to the concerns about the impact of what Trump might say.
Okay, so I think it's a good like general description, but let's like talk about the issue specifically here, right, with Trump's attacks on Merchan's daughter. What is the case that this could undermine the integrity of the trial, right? I mean, she's not party to the case. She's not a witness. She's, you know, she's not a juror. It may be a really unpleasant and immoral and maybe even, you know, tortious thing that maybe Trump is doing, but that's, of course, for a different venue. So, you know, why should court staff or, well, why should, you know, the court's family in principle be off limits for a defendant?
I mean, I will say, so Merchan actually addresses this directly in his most recent order and says, and I'll just read it because I think it's worth dwelling on. The average observer must now, after hearing defendants' recent attacks, draw the conclusion that if they become in these proceedings, even tangentially, they should worry not only for themselves, but for their loved ones as well. That's emphasized. Such concerns will undoubtedly interfere with the fair administration of justice and constitute a direct attack on the rule of law itself. Again, all citizens called upon to participate in these proceedings, whether as a juror, witness, or in some other capacity, must now concern themselves not only with their personal safety, but with the safety and the potential for personal attacks upon their loved ones. That reality cannot be overstated. And I think it's telling that he also goes on to emphasize later in the order that Trump is in legal danger here if he decides to attack the jury. And emphasizes that the gag order, you know, extends, I believe, also to attacks on family members of witnesses. And so the concern here is very clearly, you know, we want the jury to be able to rule fairly without concern for their personal safety. We want prosecutors to not have to hold back. We want witnesses to not have to hold back, because the message that Trump is sending here is not just, you know, hey, I'm going to attack this judge's daughter if he does things I don't like, thereby pressuring the judge, but sending a message to anyone who might be involved in any way, you know, you better do what Trump wants. Otherwise, this is going to happen to you as well. And I mean, I think it's worth emphasizing also that we've seen this dynamic play out in gag orders recently, and gag orders issued by Judge Chutkan in D.C. and Justice Engoron in New York in the civil case. And I wrote a Law Firm piece about this in November. But this sort of dynamic of Trump attacking courts and attacking potential witnesses against him is a very, very familiar one. If you go back and look at Lawfare over the course of the Mueller investigation, we wrote a lot about whether or not Trump's attacks on Michael Cohen or his posts about, you know, how glad he was that Roger Stone and Paul Manafort were doing the right thing constituted witness intimidation. And the Mueller report actually includes his attacks on Michael Cohen after Cohen decided to cooperate with the government and testify against him as an example of potential obstruction of justice, precisely because of this same concern that it's, you know, distorting the workings of the court system if you're routinely sending a message that anyone who, you know, does something that you dislike will become the target of your ire and potentially, you know, have their life threatened.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's all right. And to be clear, sort of my question was more sort of to set up the issue rather than to sort of express any skepticism of the gag order. I mean, I also think that gag orders should probably include the families of the presiding judges as a matter of course. I know they frequently don't because the judge is trying to show how sort of even-handed they are. But, you know, if your concern is about allowing a defendant to undermine the integrity of a proceeding by threatening people, right? It's one thing to say, okay, well, the judge can put their big kid pants on and deal with whatever nasty stuff the defendant says about them. But you're going after the judge's family member, the judge's children, it seems pretty clear that should be within the gag order.
I mean, I worry about the security of the judges as well, too, right? Like, I understand why all of the judges have left themselves out of the gag order so far. Chutkan and Engoron did the same thing because, of course, you know, you want to play it fair, right? You want to allow the defendant to criticize you, and so on and so forth. But like, this can get really dangerous. And it is also worth noting that Judge Reggie Walton, who's a senior judge in DC, went on CNN in the aftermath of these attacks on Merchan's daughter, not to talk specifically about the New York case, although I do think he may have mentioned it at some point, but to just generally say, you know, these attacks on courts are really concerning. And one of the cases he mentioned was the case of, I believe her name is Judge Esther Salas, who is a judge in New Jersey. Defendant who had been in front of her came to her house and attacked her and her family with a gun, and her son was killed. So, you know, these security issues are real. And particularly in the case of state courts, I do worry about the extent to which the courts have the budget to protect judges and witnesses and jurors as well, right? Like in the federal courts, we have the U.S. Marshals, but I don't know if New York has anything that's sort of adequately funded for this purpose.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a partisan issue, frankly, right? I mean, there was the kind of assassination plot, or there was the kind of disturbed individual who went and got pretty close to assassinating Justice Kavanaugh, right? I mean, a few years ago, this can be a thing that I think all sides can agree on, though of course they won't, because it's all horribly politicized. Okay, so this gets then to my next questions, are kind of interrelated. Sort of one is, will this stop Trump? And two, why is Trump doing this? Is there some strategy here, either legal or political, or is this just Trump's id unleashed because he literally cannot handle himself? And I will say, I mean, I think there's a broader conversation to be had about Trump's kind of erratic postings and statements on Truth Social. I mean, he's always been an extremely erratic guy, but you know, in the last, I think, even few weeks, it's gotten, I think, appreciably worse. I mean, on Easter, for example, he, I think, posted like 70 times, unhinged, all caps, like before the morning was even over, which is kind of a lot, even by Trump's standards. There's some questions about whether he himself is kind of getting more and more erratic. But I'm curious what you all think of that.
Yeah, well, as to your first question, I mean, I was thinking back to months and months ago when analysts were all claiming that no judge would ever dare to impose a gag order on Donald Trump during campaign season. And now we're seeing them everywhere because, as we've been talking about, the threat of real, actual violence to judges, to prosecutors, to their family members are really horrifying. And we're seeing it play out in real life. It's not hypothetical anymore. But it then raises the question of, as you sort of indicated, what's going to happen if he just disregards them altogether?
Contempt of court, baby. Throw him in jail.
Right. So, I mean, I think what's interesting, and Quint, I'd love to hear from you more on this, because you had mentioned the other day that you think in some ways the statements that we have seen from Trump since the gag orders have been imposed actually suggest that they are working in some respect. So I want to come to you with that. But before I do, quickly, I'll just say I did look at what the sanctions options are in New York State. And because Justice Merchan also actually cited the two judiciary law contempt provisions, the one that would be relevant is a fine not more than $1,000 or prison for not more than 30 days. So, you know, that's the tool that's at his disposal. There are other remedies that he could fashion in his discretion, but it will be very interesting to see. The one other thing I wanted to mention in this context, though, is that I think if you read the order carefully, it's a little bit weaker than the coverage suggests, because there's some pretty significant limiting language with regard to defining the types of statements he's not allowed to make, because it includes the limiting factor of the language is if those statements are made with the intent to materially interfere with or to cause others to materially interfere with counsel's or staff's work in this criminal case, or with the knowledge that such interference is likely to result. So that actually strikes me as a pretty high bar for getting to a determination that he has been held in contempt, that he should be held in contempt. But it is notable that he referenced it explicitly, that it's out there as a real possibility, perhaps.
I will say before I start off that New York's system for distinguishing between civil and criminal contempt is unbelievably confusing. And if you understand this, please explain it to me, because I spent so long trying to follow this. But the important thing here is, yes, under the criminal contempt statute, as Natalie said, there's a real cap on what Merchan can do. I do think that, you know, it's easy to kind of present Trump as you say, Alan, you know, someone who's just impulsive or is spinning out of control. And to an extent, I definitely think that's true. But in another sense, he's very canny. He has a kind of, you know, animal shrewdness about what he can and can't get away with. And I think we saw that in the wake of the gag orders from Chutkan and Engoron. You know, Engoron, there was this gag order where he basically told Trump and Trump's counsel to stop talking about Engoron's clerk, his chief clerk. And Trump and his team disobeyed that, I believe, twice. They were fined under the civil contempt statute, which has a little more leeway. And then they kind of stopped talking about the clerk and Chutkan's order as well. Now, there's been less occasion for Trump to try to violate that because that case has basically been on hold since December, thanks to the immunity litigation and the appellate courts. But he hasn't really gone after anyone in a way that would violate that gag order. And I think what that shows you is that, you know, every time that these gag orders were put in place, there were a ton of conversations about, you know, how are they going to enforce this? Are they going to hold him in contempt? That was how I framed my article for Lawfare, was, you know, what's going to happen to him contempt wise. But I do think he is actually like, he will walk right up to the line of what is acceptable, and he'll maybe like stick his toe over it. But if he's batted back, he's pretty good at determining where the line is. So, you know, in the original gag order, it included, you know, counsel, for example, and court staff, but it didn't include Merchan and it didn't include family members. And so he, you know, he found the loophole and he drove a truck through it. And now that loophole has been closed. And so what he's doing instead is being a little cute and, you know, pointing to Fox segments that talk about things that he said before, but he's not violating the order. And that is frustrating, but I do kind of think that it shows that, you know, this is, it's working in the sense that it's, you know, making him hold back. Now, maybe, you know, the better outcome would be if we had a time machine and Merchan could just include himself and his family in the gag order from the beginning. There are reasons he didn't do that. But I do think that, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he gets fined. You know, he, you know, flies off the handle and gets mad and truths something intemperate and then gets slapped with a fine. But it does suggest to me that, you know, his kind of ability to understand what is and isn't permitted is actually maybe better than we're giving him credit for, until, you know, he gets angry and posts something inadvisable on social media late at night.
I love your how do you describe it? Like animal intelligence?
Yeah.
Like I have this image of like a really talented mouse managing to get the cheese and the peanut butter exactly. out of the trap, you know, somehow just with really finessing it.
I was thinking like a fox or something, but a mouse works too.
An surprisingly agile bear.
I'm curious, though, what do you guys make of the interaction of this with the presidential campaign? Because, you know, as I said earlier, I was thinking back to when everyone was saying this couldn't possibly happen. No judge would ever dare impose a gag order. And it was so tied up with his running for president. And it's the First Amendment issues are going to be even worse because the public has a right to hear what he has to say and all of that. But it strikes me also, as you were saying, he's a little bit more controlled on social media, that he may be less controlled at a campaign event, for example. And I don't think we've seen that happen specifically yet, but it seems to me a possible venue for, you know, the moment at which he might actually violate the order. But I'm just curious how you guys think about the interaction of those two things.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is, how much does the order really limit his ability to make his case publicly? I mean, he can still attack the judge. Can he attack counsel? Can he go after Bragg himself?
No. Okay, so he can't. That was in the original gag order.
Okay, that's notable. That's a real restriction. But he can still go after the judge. And, you know, if you think that the main messaging that Trump wants here is they're out to get me, they being who knows, right? As long as he has some avatar for who the they is, and that avatar is going to be the judge, then I do think he can sort of make his case and it doesn't interfere that much with, maybe interferes with what he wants to say, but I don't think it interferes with his ability to sort of generally say that he is being unfairly criticized, persecuted, martyred, whatever the case is. Now, I do think there's a point, right? If his criticism of the judge kind of reaches a fever pitch to the extent that the judge starts getting death threats, you know, there really are concerns about the judge's safety, then the judge has to figure out, you know, do I just kind of have to do a much broader gag order, which would indeed raise First Amendment concerns? Though, of course, at that point, the First Amendment concerns probably would give way to the substantiated concerns about the safety of court personnel, including the judge himself, right? But I do think at this point, there is a kind of unspoken detente equilibrium between Trump and the judge in this case and the other cases in which, you know, Trump kind of has a sense of what the lines are. But the and in return, the judge gives him enough leeway to fundraise off of this case, which I think is kind of where we're going to end up, I suspect. Because I think, to your point, Quinta, Trump has a good kind of animal instinct about this. And there is a difference between a gag order and literally throwing the dude in jail, which, you know, although I joked about it earlier, would take a lot. And again, you can see based on how kind of carefully Merchan has crafted the gag order, leaving him, Merchan that is, a lot of leeway to not throw Trump in jail, not to sort of issue anything really substantial in terms of contempt if Trump crosses the line.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also maybe a dynamic where the lower court judges here need to craft their orders carefully because they want them to hold up on appeal. We saw in the Chutkin gag order, for example, that the D.C. Circuit narrowed it significantly so that the gag order still held, but that it was really constrained to Trump talking about, you know, the prosecutors and other figures, you know, how their conduct related to this specific case. So he could still say more general things, you know, out of concern for Trump's First Amendment rights, especially as a candidate for president. And so I can imagine that, you know, if you're Merchan, you really want to be laying the groundwork here to show that you gave all the leeway, right? You played it totally straight. You weren't going against Trump in any way, because if the gag order is appealed and it's struck down or narrowed, then Trump has another, you know, way that he can say, aha, the courts are, you know, it's unfair and this judge is biased and so on and so forth. Well, let us take a trip across the Atlantic to keep up with recent happenings in the Israeli offensive on Gaza. So it has been quite a week. So on April 1st, not an April Fool's joke, there was an Israeli strike in Syria, in, of all places, the Iranian embassy in Damascus, that killed three Iranian generals and four officers in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. April 1st was also the deadline for the Israeli government to begin the process of conscripting ultra-Orthodox men into the IDF, ending their traditional exemption and potentially causing real problems for Netanyahu's coalition. And then the next day, on April 2nd, there was an Israeli strike in Gaza, three strikes actually, that hit a convoy of three vehicles from the charity World Central Kitchen, which is run by Jose Andres, and killed seven aid workers, including a number of people who were citizens from the U.S., Australia, and other Western countries. So I think it's been a rocky week of news. And I also just saw that the reporter Barak Ravid just reported that Benny Gantz has called for new elections. So lots of stuff is happening. Honestly, I think Natalie and I were discussing this ahead of time, and we truly do not know where to start with this sequence of news. But I think it might be useful just to kind of pause for a moment and think about, you know, what questions these stories raise for us, because I certainly don't know what answers I have. So, Natalie, I mean, starting on whichever one of those stories you want to begin with, what are you kind of thinking about in relation to this news?
Yeah, I mean, as you and I were discussing beforehand, I think in particular because I am so anti-hot take, and I am particularly anti-hot take when it comes to this conflict and Israel and Gaza and domestic Israeli issues and regional issues. I mean, there are too many opinions and not enough actual knowledge. So I do think that all of this is complicated and there are no clear conclusions to be made. But that said, I think one thing that really strikes me as important to delve into a little bit more, well, all of these are, but I will start, I guess, in no particular order with the Supreme Court decision, because I think this is a topic that people may be generally aware of, but I think it's a moment to pause on the really, really dramatic fissure in Israeli society and therefore in Israeli politics that is being exposed by this. But it's not a new issue. I mean, this decision comes out of procedures that started actually back in 1998 when this exemption for Haredi men was found to be discriminatory and illegal. And there have been just often on developments throughout and more litigation and more developments in the legislation. But this ruling is based on a ruling from 2017, and there were various procedural things that happened since then and delays, and this change came because a deadline came for continuing temporarily the subsidies that were being paid to yeshivas that are supporting Haredi men. They're about, I think, about 50% of Haredi, that is ultra-Orthodox men in Israel, don't have any income. They're supported entirely by these subsidies. But this is that this all invokes a really major tension and incredibly complicated balancing act that the Israeli government has tried to, not this particular government of Netanyahu, but the Israeli government since its founding has had to struggle to find a balance and a way to accommodate these really very different interests. And it's manifesting now in the coalition that currently exists because it's very narrow. Netanyahu has 64 of the 120 seats in the Knesset, and several of them belong to small parties, but some are extreme nationalists and some are ultra-Orthodox. And the ultra-Orthodox party leaders have said really unequivocally that they intend to withdraw from the coalition if this happens, and it has happened. So it's going to be significant, of course, for the Netanyahu government. It doesn't surprise me at all that new elections are being called for. You know, how much of that is this versus this and everything else, I think, is interesting, but probably ultimately irrelevant. I think it's also just worth emphasizing that this is such a serious issue for Israeli society and culture, in addition to the immediate impact on politics and perhaps on the war effort as well. But that's, frankly, a whole separate issue.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way of articulating the sort of political problem here that Netanyahu faces. And I think it's worth then thinking about, okay, so what happens if ultimately he's not able to keep this together? Because it's not just the Haredi parties that he has to keep happy. It's his secular right-wing parties as well that he has to keep happy. And they don't love the fact that there's this large group of Israelis that doesn't have to sacrifice in the same way that everyone else does. So it's really between a rock and a hard place, right? And this may be the thing more than anything that ultimately topples him. And that'd be good, right? I think generally, I think there's an increasing recognition that Benjamin Netanyahu may be the single worst prime minister in Israel history, maybe the single worst leader in the history of all Jews. I think there was a good Tom Friedman op-ed making that argument some time ago, which I found reasonably compelling.
Even if you look back at like...
I don't know, there's some bad ones in like Leviticus, I'm sure. There was like Zebediah, Fire, Cry. I don't know. There's these names are just amazing.
But you know what? Yeah. Netanyahu, he's getting there.
You know, we can retroactively add him to the Lamentations of Jeremiah. So that'd be a good thing, probably. But then the question, right, is, okay, so what happens next? So Likud would probably lose based on the polls. You'd have some more centrist, kind of center-left, moderate coalition, maybe headed by Benny Gantz. And this then raises the question of what would this mean for the war in Gaza? And there, the answer is unclear. I mean, I think one thing people outside Israel don't really appreciate is that the war in Gaza is quite popular among Israelis. Now, maybe not every Israeli thinks that the war in Gaza should be prosecuted in exactly the way Benjamin Netanyahu wants to prosecute it. But certainly, it's not like there's this giant, you know, center middle that wants to have an immediate ceasefire and not enter Rafah and kind of try to sue for peace with Hamas. You know, the Israeli society is quite united on the need, as they understand it, to destroy Hamas and really change the status quo. So in that sense, you know, we might not see a really profound shift in the current Israeli military strategy. What you might, however, see is a shift in what Israelis are saying about what happens next. You know, who ends up running Gaza after Hamas is destroyed? Do you bring in the PLO? How do you reconstruct that society? I mean, that would be notable, right? I mean, I think that what a lot of folks, and I will, you know, put myself in this camp, that are kind of in principle sympathetic to the Israeli goal of, if not at least destroying, then degrading Hamas's capabilities to such an extent that they can no longer rule Gaza. what they have been troubled with is that there's no clear, okay, what happens after that, right? You know, given the sort of truly horrible civilian casualties that have happened in Gaza, which is, again, some combination of Israel's much more aggressive posture in this conflict than their previous conflicts. And in addition to the fact that this is a uniquely difficult urban terrain in which to fight, in which Hamas is very clearly using the entire population as a sort of human shield, that combination, that is very hard to stomach if you can't justify that to some higher purpose, which is that this will all end with some progress towards an actual durable resolution of the underlying conflict. And that is something that Benjamin Netanyahu, whether for kind of ideological reasons or more just for his own right-wing survival, has never shown any interest in. You know, even as this war in Gaza is being prosecuted quite brutally, you know, other members of Netanyahu's coalition are busy trying to annex more of West Bank land, which is obviously not going to be terribly helpful to any sort of durable peace. One may very cautiously be optimistic, though Israel experts will know more about this than I do, that someone like Benny Gantz, who's quite hawkish on the war itself, might nevertheless prove somewhat more long-term minded in terms of what happens next, such that, you know, 5-10 years down the line, we can say this was a horrible conflict, but it was in the service of something that is more just and more durable.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I guess I worry that it's sort of gone past the point of no return in terms of what it's in service to at this point. I mean, by some arguments, Gaza is heading toward a famine in such a way that it's not going to be averted. It's just a question of when it sort of hits that point, however you measure that, and how bad it might be. I mean, you look at the pictures of towns and cities in the strip, and it just, like, it looks like the Russian invasion of Grozny in the early 2000s, where they just bombed the city to the ground. I mean, there is nothing there. And I think that, I mean, I want to make sure we touch on the World Central Kitchen strike, because I do think that that is really important in kinds of, in terms of thinking about, like, what Israel's goals are here. You know, if your goal is to target Hamas, which is what the Israeli government claims is its goal, what purpose does it serve? So the Israeli government has said, you know, oh, we thought that there was a Hamas guard in the convoy, or maybe it was an accident or something. There's been some reporting that indicates that this may stem from the combination of loose rules of engagement and decisions by officers on the ground who have a fair amount of leeway to make the call about what to do, and who made a really bad call here. But, you know, this is not apparently the first time that World Central Kitchen had run into the IDF. There's the Washington Post has a report that said that they'd been hit with sniper fire from an IDF sniper in the last week and had complained about it. It's also worth pointing out, you know, there are three vehicles in this convoy. All three of them were hit. Include, like, one after the other as people moved wounded workers from one car to the other, and then the final one was hit and they were killed. Like, just what are you doing? It's really, really hard to look at this as in any way justifiable. And the government seems to have realized that they made kind of an error here. There's a very weird video of Netanyahu sort of saying, oh, you know, we're sorry. But he looks like he's smirking the whole time. It's very strange. The IDF put forward some less smug videos where they're sort of apologizing. But I do think that that strike to me kind of is a encapsulation of just the incredible willingness to exert violence in a way that achieves no obvious strategic end and that except in causing enormous harm to the civilian population of Gaza, specifically because, you know, look, like civilian death is always a horror. The death of any aid worker would be a horror. It is, in the crassest sense, really dumb to go after or to have killed, let's say, since we don't really know what happened, aid workers who are part of Jose Andres's charity, because people in D.C. love Jose Andres. He's a local boy. Everyone goes to his restaurants downtown for their little power lunches. You know, he's not, you know, easily demonized or anything like that.
That is indeed crass and 100% correct.
But it's totally true, right? Like, I think it will actually make people on the Hill upset in a way that, you know, all of the other atrocities have not. Yes. And so it just...
Of all the restaurateurs to go after.
Genuinely.
Right? Yeah, I know. It's insane. It's insane to even phrase it that way, but you are 1,000% correct. No, I think that's right, and I think this is a case in which there is a really big difference between whether this was an accident and whether this was we thought there was one Hamas person traveling with this convoy. I mean, you know, even if your rules of engagement allow for some civilian casualties, I don't know, this seems particularly insane. But again, I think it's just so easy to get so focused on the this strike, that strike. And of course, it's important, right? I mean, that's why we have rules of engagement, rules of war, and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, ultimately, it's the question of, is there a strategic objective that at the end of the day is what makes, in the broad strokes, the war just or not, right? And that's what I think Netanyahu has been singularly incapable of offering.
Well, I want to push back, though, on focusing on one strike or the other, because the thing about focusing on this strike is the facts are so bad. And it's hard to imagine how this particular strike could be legally justified. And Israel has traditionally argued that it is complying with the laws of war, that it takes those obligations seriously, you know, does all the time evoke the point that you made earlier, Alan, that this is a very difficult environment in which to operate militarily because of both the nature of the urban and extremely dense area that Gaza is, and also because of the fact that Hamas will regularly use civilian objects for military aims in its own violation of the laws of war. But Israel still has its obligations, no matter how much Hamas is not abiding by its own. And for this particular strike, it's worth focusing on because, as I said, the facts are so bad that it is hard to imagine, unless this was purely a mistake, which only raises questions about Israel's compliance with the laws of war in how it is ensuring its own command and its own internal compliance within its military. You know, that's one possibility here. This was purely a mistake. Another possibility is that it was sloppy and someone decided that this convoy that was clearly marked as a humanitarian organization, which was, according to reports, the Israeli military had been informed of the World Central Kitchen's movements. They had just left a food warehouse. These were known paths for them to take. That someone decided, no, actually, this is a legitimate target, despite the protection of humanitarian efforts under international law, which is just, even if there had been a Hamas member as part of the convoy, even if that were part of the fact pattern, it's very hard to imagine justifying this as a discriminate and proportionate attack. So this one is worth focusing on because whether it's a mistake or not, it is a serious violation of something that Israel has as a legal obligation. And if it is one example in which Israel really fell down on its otherwise stated commitment to the law of war, no matter how much others might disagree with the assessments that they're making, no, they really do take these obligations seriously, even if they come to different conclusions. This is different. And it's a very, I mean, for all of the reasons that Quinta said, it's going to get more attention in D.C. and also deserves the attention that it gets because the facts are so bad.
No objection from me.
Well, speaking of Israeli strikes, let's talk about one that was definitely intentional, which is this absolutely bizarre strike on the Iranian embassy in Damascus that took out, I think the count is seven, at least seven high-ranking IRGC officials. This seems like an escalation. I confess I read the article and thought, oh, okay, we're doing a regional conflict now. That's great. I mean, Alan, how worried should I be?
I mean, not worried. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a ballsy move. I mean, one, you're attacking Iran. Two, you're attacking it in a third country. Three, you're firing at an embassy. I am not a expert in the Vienna consular laws or treaties. I think that's what it's called, but I'm pretty sure that they frown on attacking other people's embassies. I'd be curious to know what the rules on that are. You know, it's interesting to sort of ask, what are the effects going to be on this? But we can also ask sort of, why would Israel do this? And it strikes me that there are kind of three possible reasons, or at least three. So one possible reason is because it's just a target of opportunity, right? This has nothing to do with the war in Gaza. It's just that Israel is trying to find whatever way it can to weaken Iran, which obviously is probably its number one enemy. And it had an opportunity to do so, and it did so. Two, that Israel is trying to rebuild credible deterrence. Obviously, the attack on October 7th was both horrifying in terms of the you know, civilian deaths in Israel, but kind of more strategically, it was just a huge black eye to Israel's credibility in the region, right? Both in terms of its credibility in knowing everything and seeing everything, but also just in the challenge, right, that it presented, right? It said, you know, Israel, you seem so scary, but we, Hamas, were, and kind of by extension, Hamas's backers, some of which are Iran, though the relationship there is obviously quite complicated. We're not that scared of you. And honestly, just as in some sense, the United States invaded Iraq after 9/11 to reestablish credibility.
Quintus, that's a comparison because, that really fills you with confidence about how well thought out this was.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I thought you're going to laugh at me because I'm now parroting J.D. Vance. But, you know, even a stopped clock is correct twice a day. He's not wrong. It is kind of the reason we did it.
Whether it worked is a different question.
Yeah, exactly. Just as the United States invaded Iraq after 9/11, in some sense, to establish kind of we're back deterrence and credibility. Again, it didn't work well. That might be part of what Israel is doing. And then finally, and this is a kind of a particularly cynical explanation, and I don't know if it's true or not, but at this point, we should consider all possibilities. If Israel manages to get itself involved in a regional war, that may distract in certain ways from what's happening in Gaza. And it may put Israel's main backer, the United States, in a position of really having to sort of go full tilt in Israel's defense, because it's one thing to feel bad for the Gazans. You know, it's a very different thing to feel bad for the Iranians. So I don't know what the effect is going to be. Certainly, Israel and Iran have shown both simultaneously the willingness to use force to defend their interests, but also a very canny, speaking of animal intelligence, right, kind of ability to stay kind of right on that precipice of, I don't want to say a cold conflict, because again, firing on another country's embassy is not exactly part of a cold conflict, but kind of keeping the conflict tamped down, simmering, lightly bubbling, a braising conflict. But I don't know, those are my thoughts.
I think there is so much to talk about with even just the strike in Damascus. But instead of doing that, let us talk about things that remind you of Thanksgiving, like turduckens. So this very obscure reference to turduckens is from a tweet courtesy of Elise Thomas, who's a disinformation specialist at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. as you mentioned up top, Ellen, she was writing about a tweet in which Alex Jones retweeted a post commenting on an article. The article was Russian propaganda from RT. And the post that Jones was retweeting was by an account that is known to be part of a Chinese Communist Party influence operation. So this increase in Chinese influence operations in the United States, especially around the election, is something that ODNI had actually – sorry, that's the Office of the Director of National Intelligence – had warned about in a report in February. And it's leading to a bunch of comparisons with Russia's activities around the 2016 election. But I think one thing that particularly stood out to me in Elisa's tweet and in looking into it a little bit more deeply is that there's been a really significant improvement in the CCP's campaigns that had started much more as a bunch of bots and had made sort of silly mistakes and used poor English and used accounts that first were tweeting entirely in Mandarin and then all of a sudden switched only to English and started pretending that they were American account holders. But now, apparently, the efforts, the disinformation efforts and campaigns are getting much more sophisticated. And according to Elise Thomas, this particular tweet is linked to something called Spamouflage. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
There's all of these disinformation campaigns. Like, the companies just give them the stupidest names.
I do wonder about the origin of this name.
I think it's Spamouflage because they post a lot. Basically.
Okay.
So it's spam and it's camouflage because they're pretending to not be who they are. Okay. See?
But maybe they're moving more into the ouflage part of their name than the spam because apparently they have fewer accounts doing less tweeting, but more, in a more sophisticated manner. So I guess the opening question on all of this is, Alan and Quinta, how scared do we need to be of Chinese Communist Party influence campaigns?
I'm shaking in my boots. I mean, look,
I don't know.
Yeah, I think that is this a problem? Yes. Do we need to be super duper terrified? No. Would it be better if we had a government infrastructure that was capable of dealing with these issues and coordinating with platforms on them instead of a situation in which platforms have systematically eviscerated their trust and safety capabilities? Or in the case of Elon Musk, sort of decided as an ideological matter that they don't want those people there anymore, that would definitely be better. But I do feel like, and this is not, by the way, not at all shade on Elise Thomas, who has done great work and is not at all exaggerating the implications of this, to be clear. I did kind of read that story and think, uh-oh, we're going to be headed back to the like 2016 Russian disinformation discourse of, you know, you saw one meme and therefore, you've now, you know, turned into a meat puppet wired directly to the Kremlin, right? Like, that's just not how anything works.
Meat puppet. Nice. Classy. I mean, I agree with you, Quinta. You know, it's very unclear still, I think, to this day, to what extent the Russian disinformation campaign really affected the 2016 election. And I don't think there's any reason to think that, given everything we know now, given how, frankly, even more polarized we are today, that a Chinese disinformation campaign would have much of a greater effect. Now, that being said, it is just kind of an obnoxious attack on a country's sovereignty to mess in its elections. And so just kind of definitionally, it's always a big deal. And also, despite what I just said, when you have razor sharp margins, right? You know, if the election is decided by 20,000 votes in Michigan, which is completely possible, right? You know, Biden's been doing better in his polls in the last couple of weeks. But still, it's basically still a kind of a coin flip election if you look at the polls. It doesn't take that much to swing the election one way or the other. So I do think it's something we need to be sort of concerned about. I think one thing that's interesting is which candidate the Chinese are supporting, which is Trump, you know. But let's assume that the bulk of the support is these kind of fake MAGA accounts. What does that say about China? Is it that the Chinese think that Trump's policies would be better for China? I mean, it's kind of surprising given, you know, Trump's demonization of China throughout his campaigns and his presidency. Or more generally, is it just that, you know, China recognizes that a Trump administration is, even if less friendly to China, just less competent, and one that creates even more divisions in the United States, just generally weakens America internally? I mean, I think that's probably what's going on. And that's a sad statement, frankly, about our current politics.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what direction Chinese interventions have gone in past elections. And I confess I don't strongly recall. I mean, it doesn't hugely surprise me that they would be going after the right, because if your goal is just to kind of stir things up, it's frankly easier to do that on the right than it is on the left. And if, you know, you want to help incite political violence and sort of destabilize the American system of government more broadly, you know, makes sense that you would kind of toss fuel onto the fire that's already burning, so to speak. And it's also worth noting, you know, in 2016, there were plenty of posts from the Russian Internet Research Agency that were, you know, people pretending to be American leftists, often pretending to be Black Americans, saying, you know, oh, I'm not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Right. So, and sort of attacking Clinton from the left. So there's a flexibility in terms of how people are, you know, thinking about what these kinds of operations are hoping to achieve. Or alternatively, you know, we're seeing a very small slice of what the CCP is up to right now. And it's hard to say.
Yeah. I mean, Quinto, you mentioned this a bit, but I know you've both been giving it a lot of thought in other contexts, in particular with respect to cases that we're hearing here in the U.S. But what do we think about the fact that content moderation on platforms is becoming more and more controversial, and the effect of that is pretty clearly that it is just decreasing at a really remarkable clip? There is still the outstanding question of how much influence this really has on our elections. But I think that's somewhat separate from what is the role of a platform in cleaning up, really, in this case, known examples of influence operations. I mean, is this something that we want to think of in the broader context of content moderation, the content moderation controversy?
It's a big question. I think it's also worth noting that, you know, we heard the Supreme Court heard oral arguments recently in Murphy v. Missouri, the jawboning case, and seemed pretty clearly not inclined to side with the states arguing that government coordination with platforms on these kinds of things is impermissible under the First Amendment. And so I would hope that, you know, once we get a ruling on that sometime this spring, or early summer, that that will help the federal government feel a little more confident in its ability to coordinate with these platforms. But yeah, I mean, it's also true that just the platform's capacity for this kind of work is lower because they've cut these roles as part of cost-cutting measures, basically. It's most dramatic at Twitter, but it's happened elsewhere too. And so I do think that that is potentially concerning going into a really hectic election year. It's also true that there has been a real rollback in transparency. So Musk obviously has sharply limited access to Twitter's API. You can basically only access it if you have an amount of cash on hand that is totally unrealistic for any researcher or academic. Meta just announced that it's shutting down the transparency tool CrowdTangle. There are real limitations that are sort of have been newly imposed in terms of researchers' ability to get data from these platforms, and that data is what allows them to catch these things in action. So I think that's another component as well, that the sort of third civil society prong is severely limited in what it can do.
Well, we're going to have to leave the conversation there, but it would not be Rational Security if we did not also leave you with object lessons for the week. I'll go first. My object lesson this week is the new Netflix show, The Three-Body Problem, which my wife and I are binging. I mean, we don't binge anything because we get like 20 minutes after the kids go to sleep before we pass out, but those are a wonderful 20 minutes. And so we are watching this show in 20-minute intervals. It's a very famous, it's based on a very famous trilogy of books by the Chinese sci-fi author Lu Xichen about, well, I won't say about what it's about, because if you haven't read it, it is truly extremely trippy, but it involves aliens, which is great. It involves aliens and science. There's apparently like a 30-hour or 40-hour incredibly faithful adaptation of the books that's been made in China. And I think you can stream it or somehow access it. It's obviously in Chinese, which I would be interested in watching, actually. This is much more of a American version of it. It's created by the same people that made Game of Thrones. I found the first episode, I will admit, a little kind of tonally weird, but once the kind of mystery picks up, it's just extremely watchable. So highly recommended, Three Body Problem on Netflix. Quinta, you next.
I would like to recommend a New Yorker article, because I'm very sophisticated, by Sam Knight, titled, What Have 14 Years of Conservative Rule Done to Britain? Which, as the title suggests, is kind of a retrospective on the last 14 years of Tory rule in the UK, and how it's kind of, I mean, Knight's argument is essentially destroyed the country for no good reason. There are a lot of shocking statistics in there about how health outcomes have declined. There has apparently been a return of rickets in the UK, which that's not good. And just sort of catastrophic cuts to all kinds of social services as a function of the really, really harsh austerity measures that the UK and that the Tories put into effect after the 2008 financial crisis, in which the government has sort of just doubled down on more and more and more. I confess, I kind of, you know, keep an eye on British politics, because sometimes it's nice to make fun of the government of a country that's not your own, but where, you know, it's the same language and there's a shared cultural heritage, so you can sort of feel in the know as you laugh. But I had not realized just quite how stark the sort of economic situation is, the sort of total lack of government funding for all kinds of services, including the NHS, the just really, really dire situation of Britain that seems both to have led it to choose Brexit and has continued and worsened very predictably after Brexit. So it was really kind of a shocking article. It's incredibly well written. I think the author is a well-known writer on British politics, and this is drawn from a ton of interviews that he conducted with Tory politicians and advisors. So really eye-opening and also kind of depressing. So this will not cheer you up after this episode, but I do recommend reading it.
Eye-opening and depressing, the platonic Quinta Jurassic object lesson, everyone.
I agree. I thought that article was fascinating and depressing. And I read it because I, too, am sophisticated. And I, too, like Quinta, have a depressing recommendation, which is...
Can none of you people just recommend television? It's not that complicated. Just come on the show, recommend some television.
I haven't watched anything recently.
Yeah.
Well, so fancy.
I am recommending something that I have not actually listened to yet. But this is season 4 of Serial, which is the podcast series made famous many years ago, which this season is about Guantanamo. And as I have mentioned, I have not actually listened to this other than the trailer. And it is entirely possible and actually quite likely that I will have all sorts of problems with it. But I am pleading with the listener to please listen to it, because I will take absolutely any opportunity to remind people that Guantanamo is still around, that it is still – there are still human beings who are locked up there. There are 30 – just for your quick stats check, there are 30 detainees still at Guantanamo. Only 10 of them are actually – in the commission system, having their cases adjudicated. And 16 of them have been cleared for release and are just waiting to be let out. 3 of them have been cleared for release for more than a decade. The series, as I understand it from the trailer, is looking much broader at Guantanamo. It sounds like the first episode is actually about sort of the place and the ambiance, which is so weird. And I will just say that there is an incredible cognitive dissonance when you go down there as a lawyer, as I did. For close listeners of the show, you probably will know that I represented a Guantanamo detainee for about 8 years. And the first time, and really the first couple of times that I went down there, the confluence of the fact that it is a beautiful beach locale with happy officers and members of the military serving, often after a hardship tour because it's close to the United States and it's lovely and it's a sort of cool place to hang out, juxtaposed with I'm here to represent someone in the military commissions, is just very deeply weird. So I'm eager to listen to it. And as I said, I just really hope people will give it a try to think about the legacy of Guantanamo.
Well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. So be sure to visit lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other podcast series, including The Aftermath. And be sure to follow us on Twitter or X at RATL Security, and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. Also, sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. And check out our ongoing auction of cool Lawfare swag at givebutter.com/Trump Trials. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osmond of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. And we are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patya. On behalf of my co-host Quinta and our special guest Natalie Orpit, I am Alan Rosenstein, and we will talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.